The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Tonight we explore seeing the divine, which could mean seeing the Virgin in a tortilla or the burning bush in the Sinai Peninsula. Our evening speakers are Dr. Michael A. Arbib and Dr. Lisa Battelle. Your knowledgeable host for this evening is Margaret Wertheim, who is the co-founder of the Institute for Figuring, an organization based in Los Angeles that promotes the public understanding of the poetic and aesthetic dimensions of science and mathematics. And I think tonight we will be exploring certainly the poetic and aesthetic dimensions of neuroscience. Margaret Wertheim is a science writer and the author of books on the cultural history of physics, including Pythagoras's Trousers, A History of the Relationship Between Physics and Religion in Western Culture, and The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace, A History of Space from Dante to the Internet. She is currently a contributor to the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, and a marvelous project of hers, which she may not bring up tonight, a crocheted Great Barrier Reef of Australia, is going to be on display at Track 16, opening in January. So you'll want to get more information about that. Maybe she'll say something about that tonight. After the talks tonight, both Dr. Arbib and Dr. Battelle will be giving a talk, and then they will be in conversation with Margaret, after which we will open up to you. And we just ask that you wait until the microphone comes around to you, because we do record for podcast. And one last thing, if you turn off your cell phones and pagers, and Margaret and Dr. Arbib will both be signing their books in the lobby afterwards tonight. So please welcome Margaret Wertheim. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming. And as Louise mentioned, this is the fourth and final event in our neuroscience and perception series on seeing and being. And I just wondered, how many of you have actually been to one of these events before? Oh, that's great. Cool. When Louise and I first started discussing this series, we both had it in mind from the beginning that we'd like to do an event on neuroscience and religion. And it seemed to me that if we were going to discuss this series, it would be important, if possible, not just to discuss it from all of the advances in neuroscience and the new discoveries that we're finding out about how the brain works, but also from the perspective of someone who is knowledgeable about religion. So I was eager in this event to have not just a scientist's perspective, but someone who could tell us about, as it were, religion from the inside. So tonight's event is going to be slightly different from the previous ones in that we have a historian of religion and a neuroscientist to discuss these issues with us. I have no idea whether they will agree with each other, disagree with each other, or to what extent, but I'm sure it'll be a fascinating discussion. We've got two speakers, and as Louise said, both Michael and Lisa will give us a short presentation first. Then the order of events is that I'll have a bit of a discussion with them together before we open up to you. So let me just introduce them both together so that they can follow one another. Lisa will go first, and then followed by Michael Arbib. Our first speaker, Dr. Lisa Battelle, is a professor of history of religion at USC. She's the author of many papers and books looking at women's religious experiences and communities throughout history, particularly in the Middle Ages. She's also the creator and host of a website on this subject called Monastic Matrix, which is a fantastic resource for people interested in religious communities through the ages. Dr. Battelle has received many honours and awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, and recently she's been specifically writing about religious visions in the USA Today, which I'm sure we'll hear more about as the evening progresses. Our second speaker is Dr. Michael Arbib, and when you look at Michael's homepage at USC, he's also at USC, you would be forgiven for thinking that he was the professor of everything. He is He is professor of many things, including a professor of computer science. He's also a professor of biological sciences, bioengineering, electrical engineering, neuroscience, and psychology. In addition to all of that, he's the director of the USC Brain Project. His own research areas include computational and cognitive neuroscience, mirror neurons, the brain mechanisms of language, and neuroinformatics. He's also interested specifically in the interface between science and religion, which is how I first met him at a conference on this subject. So, as Louise said, after the speakers have finished and we've had a bit of a discussion, we hope that you will all feel free to weigh in with your own comments, questions, and any expressions of your own faith. And please welcome tonight Lisa Battelle.
So Michael's the professor of everything, and I live in the 6th century. I'm actually writing two books, or at least plotting in my head two books right now, and one is about a modern vision event that happens once a month in the Mojave Desert, where a woman sees the Virgin Mary, and people come to watch her watch the Virgin Mary. But I started out on this project by planning to write a book about visions in the very early Middle Ages, in the 5th and 6th and 7th century. And I feel that these two projects are mutually influential, that studying the past helps me understand religious phenomena today and vice versa. So when Margaret asked me to take part tonight, I thought what I should do is show you some of the connections. And by doing that, to make three points about religious visions in social and cultural contexts. Now, I do live in the 6th century, but I get out once in a while, and I surf the web when I do. And I don't know if you've noticed recently, but there have been an increasing number of reports of miraculous manifestations, of visions, of apparitions. And as an historian of Christianity, I tend to focus on the Christian ones that I notice. But this is the famous, for example, Virgin in the grilled cheese sandwich that was all over the news a couple years ago. A woman was cooking up grilled cheese, I think, in Florida, and noticed before she finished it off that the Virgin's face had appeared there. A casino bought it for $20,000 on eBay. And not to be outdone, someone found the face of Jesus in a pancake not long after that. There's quite a variety of food products now with miraculous manifestations on them. This is Virgin Mary as a pretzel, although it looks to me like a treble clef, but this is how it's been marketed on again on eBay. This comes from the Weekly World News in 2000. It's, as you can see, face of Satan in the clouds over the Capitol. People interpreted it as an omen of 9/11. This is an om cow, just in case you think these things were limited to Christian tradition. And there have been actually sightings of Allah fishes and things like that, too. So some of this is creeping over to other religions. But by and large, these phenomena, when they're reported, are interpreted as being from within the Christian and even the Catholic tradition, which is what intrigues me, of course. And the pollsters and academics have got on to this trend. There have been lots of polls recently, and you can find these on the web too, to assess the religiosity of people in modern American society. And I'm assuming you can see the numbers, but I was quite astonished, actually, by this particular Gallup poll, which suggests that the great majority of people say that they believe in God, in heaven, in hell, in angels, and so forth. So, you know, this makes me feel right at home in the modern world. Sixth century has come back in some ways. Or maybe things haven't actually changed that much from a period when people were willing to publicly express and demonstrate their religious beliefs. And, you know, as a medievalist, I would be quick to point out, or at least to argue, that people are not more or less gullible now than in the Middle Ages or vice versa. I always try to teach my students that people weren't necessarily naive, superstitious, stupid, resistant to rational thought in the Middle Ages. they thought about reality in different ways, and the social cultural context made the expression of their religious beliefs also different. They were allowed or felt comfortable talking about religion in different ways than people in other societies at other times. So I want to make three basic points about the history of Christian visions and things that link people from the beginning of Christianity to people now who are seeing Virgin Mary and the grilled cheese or whatever they say they're seeing these days. And I will make almost no reference to science here, so that's for Michael to do. The possibility of having a religious vision is built into Christian doctrine. It's in the Gospels. You can see in the earliest Christian texts, Christian communities, Christian thinkers working out what it meant to see something miraculous. How does one encounter God face to face? How does one express such an experience? How does one prove or convey that to other people in a way that seems valid and meaningful? And they inherited this tradition from other religious groups in the first couple centuries of the Christian era. There was a long Jewish tradition of prophecy and vision. This is a medieval depiction of Moses facing the burning bush. There was also an equally strong tradition among Roman and Greek classical societies of people seeing divinities, of having dreams in which they got direct messages from the gods. This is a picture of the god Asclepius on the right side and the goddess Hygieia talking to a man who is sleeping, who's dreaming in the temple of Asclepius. And when he awakes, he will be cured of his illnesses, or he'll get a little recipe about how to cure himself. This is what went on in these temples. So Christians were part of a larger world of people who saw all sorts of things that we might not call real in that period. And for Christians, the big problem was how to consider the possibility of seeing God face to face after Jesus, who was supposedly God and man in one, after Jesus permanently disappeared until the second coming. And this is a nice little ivory of Jesus ascending to heaven. You can see the hand of God the Father there yanking him into the clouds. So in the Gospels, several stories sort of show people, the Jesus followers, negotiating how to conceive of religious vision, how to express them, that kind of thing. There was the story of Mary Magdalene, who, after Jesus was resurrected, went into the garden of the tomb, saw somebody she didn't recognize, thought it was the gardener, and then realized it was the risen Christ. And he said to her famously, you know, don't touch me to prove what you're seeing. Go and tell others. There was the story of the doubting apostle Thomas, who not only was able to see Jesus, but to whom Jesus said, touch my wounds and see for yourself, find out for yourself, get the extra proof of touch. But then he said to Thomas, according to the Gospel of John, but those who do not demand to see proof are more blessed. So in other words, in this story, Christian writers were saying, you can still believe even if you don't see Jesus and touch physical evidence. You can still consider the possibility of direct revelation from God. And then there was the story of the Pentecost, which put the apostles, the first followers of Jesus, in a locked room where they experienced something. They didn't see God come to them. They saw little flames over each other's heads, apparently. And they started babbling in many languages. And their neighbors outside the house shouted out to them. They thought these guys were drunk. This is in the Acts of the Apostles. And Peter, St. Peter, had to stand up and say to the people outside his house, no, we're not drunk. It's just 9 in the morning. How could we be drunk? So in all of these stories, Christian writers of the first and second century were negotiating this problem of how do we see God and how do we talk about it and how do we prove it's happened? And this remained the Christian problem even until today. It's inherent in the Gospels. People can see God, but if everybody starts seeing God and saying that they've seen God and talks about ways that they've seen God, how do we figure out which visions are valid? How do we know if they're telling the truth? So from the start, there were skeptics. This is another picture of Paul having his vision. Paul very famously talked about having visions of Jesus And then said, he sort of put them in the third person and said, I know a guy who had visions. This was in his letter to Corinth. But I would never boast about that kind of thing. I could boast about it if I wanted to, but I won't because people might not trust me. They might not think my vision was valid. So all of these ways of seeing entered into the Christian canon and were tried out by Christian communities through the centuries. Eventually, a very clever theologian, St. Augustine, who was a bishop in North Africa at the end of the 300s, early 400s, theorized about different ways of seeing things. He sat down and thought about it scientifically. And this is still the basis of Catholic doctrine of visions today. Augustine said, there are different ways of seeing things. We can see them the lowest form, corporeally. That's at the bottom of the chart there. So I could stand here and look at you, and that's corporeal vision. I could also stand here and look at a pretzel shaped like the Virgin Mary and tell you it's a miraculous manifestation. But if I see it with my eyes, that's the lowest kind of seeing. I could see things spiritually. That's a better way of seeing. That's like memory or imagination. So that's when I think about things like abstract love of God. That's a different kind of seeing. But the highest form of seeing, according to Augustine and Catholic theologians now, is to see without the eyes. That's how Augustine put it, which is not something we would even recognize as seeing, right? You just experience divinity. So this was the formal solution that Catholics proposed. But throughout the ages, Christians continued to see really wacky things and had to fit them into these theological categories, explain them to their neighbors, and interpret what they meant. So throughout the Middle Ages, the period I study, from, you know, maybe 300 to 1500 of the Common Era, people saw and wrote down all sorts of things to which they attributed religious meaning. They often saw omens in nature. They would hear a loud whooshing sound and then decide whether it meant there was an earthquake coming or a flood or a storm or a war. Historians wrote these down in their historical texts. And here's an earthquake going on, although it's also a vision of the apocalypse. They would see fireballs shooting from people's heads or miraculous lights surrounding someone, and they would go back to their Bibles and figure out how to interpret it. This is a picture of St. Hildegard of Bingen, who was a famous mystic herself and wrote about her own visions. And her head's on fire, in case you haven't noticed. But some people have interpreted her visions as suggesting that she had migraines. They often saw demons and angels, and many holy men and women reported being tortured by demons. There are nice stories from the bishop called Gregory of Tours in the 6th century who wrote about demons coming in the night to torture pious monks who were praying, and the monks would have fist fights with these demons and awake in the morning with bruised jaws to prove that they had an encounter with the evil supernatural and had triumphed. So people reported these things, negotiated their meanings, wrote them down quite commonly. This is one of Hildegard's own drawings of what she saw in her visions. She referred to it as the circle of all being or divine love, that kind of thing. So sometimes people wrote down or drew their own visions. Here's another of Hildegard's visions. This one I find totally terrifying, and I don't know what's going on with that guy with the little face between his legs. But she envisioned sort of interpretations of the apocalypse. Here's her depiction of the devil, Satan, down there in the bottom, like a giant worm with legs and a face. And she herself had to tell people what these meant, because it was so hard to express what she saw personally. Others took away, as I said, physical evidence of what they saw. This is St. Francis, who not only saw a crucifix move and speak to him, but later in his life saw this little flying seraphim up above him, which actually put the wounds of Jesus directly into Francis's body, or so one of Francis's followers said. You can see from this picture, which is Giotto's rendering of this, that Francis was by himself when it happened. There might have been a monk of his spying on him as it happened, who told people so that then later Giotto could paint the scene. But this is a second point I want to make, is that people themselves decide what they see and whether to tell what they've seen to others. Then their neighbors, religious authorities, the community, nowadays newspapers or the web, negotiates what that person has seen and what it means. So it's a collective process. I'll explain that later if you want me to. The third point I want to make is that these interpretations of visions happen in different kinds of cultural, social, political, and even visual environments. So it makes sense that what people would see in 6th century France would be different from what people see and consider to be religious in 19th or 20th century America. I don't know if you've noticed the shift in reports of religious visions, but from about 1820 on, by and large, if people see Catholic visions, they see the Virgin Mary. And there are all sorts of political and cultural reasons for that. The list I handed out is actually, I'm sorry, a leftover from an earlier conference. But it lists all the reported visions, just the ones we know about, over the last century. There are many, many more that are under the radar because people have decided they can't or they don't know how to talk about them. These are the children of Medjugorje in the former Yugoslavia. Have people heard of Medjugorje? Yeah. 6 teenagers 25 years ago started seeing the Virgin Mary at the same time. The bottom image, you can see them hooked up to wires and machines. The Vatican sent scientists to sort of test them for their genuine sights. And then there's this woman that I go to watch in the desert with my comrade in scholarship, Matt Gaynor, the photographer, who's sitting back there. Wave your hand, Matt. Who took these photos. This is a woman who once a month, as I said, goes out to an almost empty space in the desert and sees the Virgin Mary. And hundreds of people go out there and they don't see the Virgin Mary, but they watch her and they take photos of the sky. And then they decode those photos. You can see a woman with a Kodak camera there, a Polaroid camera in the foreground. They decode those photos for evidence of messages from God and Mary and angels. She does one kind of seeing, they do another kind of seeing, they do it together and negotiate the meaning together. Here's a very fervent believer with her camera. And here's the visionary Maria Paula herself holding up a Kodak photo of what someone has seen in the sky and has special significance to all of them. Of course, the Bishop of Fresno and the Archbishop of LA have dismissed Maria Paula as not a genuine visionary, which is to say not someone whose messages pertain to other Catholics. And so just to sort of sum up, I would come back again to my original point, which is that there are many similarities in the visions of Christians over time, simply because everyone refers back to the same foundational texts and the doctrine that built visionary experience into the religion. But these things change over time. They take on the aspects of particular cultures. In this case, our own present day, the discourse of science and the brain and of medicine very much influence what people permit themselves to see and how they interpret it. And with that, I will let our scientists take the stage and go sit down.
Get out of this. Is there a secret to getting out of your presentation? No. Hit escape, all right. Good. Well, this is the Shroud of Turin, as seldom seen, to show the connection between Christianity and neuroscience. I must say, this talk of Lisa's is a very hard act to follow. And in part because it would be nice if I could now show you that there was definitive brain research that established that, yes, indeed, that was a Virgin Mary on the slice of toast and things of this kind. Instead, the strategy has been by neuroscientists to take an agnostic attitude, to not so much say we are going to prove that the visions are wrong or that the visions are true, but rather to try and say, can we capture people in occasions in which they are having a mystical experience of some kind? Can we see what's going on in their brain at that moment? And then can we relate that to what we know about the brain? And it's early days yet, but I hope that what I have to show you will be somewhat interesting. The classic discussion of all this is by William James, the great Harvard psychologist, who gave the Gifford Lectures in 1901, 1902 on the varieties of religious experience, what he called a study in human nature. And what I've put at the bottom of the slide is the word ultimacy that was introduced to me by Wesley Wildman, an Australian theologian, and Leslie Brothers, a Los Angeles psychiatrist, note her initials. And the point they were making is that we have a great deal of experience which is akin to a religious experience without actually being religious. And I think the next slide will give you something of this. This is not an exact photo, but it was the best I could find searching images on the web. Standing one day on the far southwest corner of Australia with a glorious sunset, a storm moving the waves, the wind racing through my hair, and without any, to my mind, religious overtones at all, I just had a feeling that I was part of something bigger. And so I think this idea that the human brain has evolved to make us feel part of something bigger. Now, that bigness doesn't have to be the whole universe. That bigness doesn't have to be the love of God. It can purely be our social interactions. And one of the findings I'll be coming back to is a suggestion that some of the brain mechanisms that seem to be exploited in some of these religious experiences may tend to be related to becoming part of a community without any implication as to whether it's religious or not. Here's just another picture of a chapel in an abbey. And again, the idea that this space is such that one can have literally an uplifting experience as one's spirit is invited to move upwards. So let me just show you a few brain images and try to tell you a little bit about what people have or have not gathered from them. So this first study I'm showing you is by Newberg and DeKeeley and their colleagues back in 2001. They used something called SPECT, which is a pretty horrible way to image the brain. Not horrible in the sense of the experience of the person being imaged, but just it's a very long exposure. It's averaging over the brain rather crudely in little lumps of brain, which is more active than another. The exposure requires many minutes. So you're not seeing the timing of activity in the brain. You're rather saying what parts of the brain are somewhat more active. And in this particular case, they found that during meditation, the parietal lobe on the right wasn't particularly active, but on the left became more active. Similarly, frontal lobe. And they tried to look at this in terms of the role of the frontal lobe in terms of being engaged in larger spatiotemporal organizations and the parietal lobe in terms of being actually practicing in the world. The suggestion was that the meditation removed you from your current interaction with the world, and as such, you would see a shift in the balance of what the world was doing during meditation compared to that. This is going to get me a little more technical, but I think in a sense is going to be a little more interesting. This was a study by Schutz and his colleagues looking at the BOLD response. BOLD is blood flow. The idea is that if you look at the way the brain works, it's not only got a collection of neurons which can carry out information processing, but the brain can actually control the capillaries, the blood vessels, so that if an area of the brain is more active than another area, it will increase the blood flow that it's receiving. So that there are now methods, functional magnetic resonance imaging, which allow you basically to make a three-dimensional map of the brain in terms of where the blood flow is greater and thus inferentially where further processing is going on. In this particular case, they were looking at Danish Christians performing silent religious prayers. And what we have over here is that they contrasted the Lord's Prayer with personal prayer, rhyme with wishing to Santa Claus, we saw that these people were very strong in their belief that God existed and very strong in their belief that Santa Claus did not exist, though a few did seem to agree that he didn't exist. And then they focused on part of the brain called the caudate nucleus. This is part of the basal ganglia, and some of you know that the basal ganglia is crucially dependent on the supply of dopamine, and that if the neurons that send the dopaminergic signal to the caudate nucleus become impaired, you get Parkinson's disease. So what they're showing here is that looking at this region of interest, this little region shown sort of in three different projections on the brain, wishing to Santa Claus and making a rhyme didn't activate it very much, but somehow personal prayer more, and the Lord's Prayer, that total involvement in an appeal to the Lord, seemed to make the largest effect. This is just a picture to show you, to make it all scientific. Here are the basal ganglia nestled in the brain, quite a dramatic structure, and in cross-section we can see what it looks like, and here is the caudate nucleus we're focusing on. And this diagram from a German neurophysiologist who works in England, Wolfram Schultz, just implicates this area that we've just talked about. The caudate is part of this striatum down here. As I told you, the dopamine neurons play a crucial role in talking to the striatum to allow it to act appropriately. And this diagram, which we don't have time to explore in full detail, but we can get a sense of... Okay, that we have trying to bring together all these things. What are expectations of reward? Do we detect that a reward has occurred? Are we predicting some rewards will occur? And so we have this great interaction of different parts of the brain involved in the reward system with this striatum, including the caudate nucleus that Schert and his colleagues imaged, playing a very important role. And so we see... this argument, they say that because they saw this involvement of this area, they say this supports the hypothesis that religious prayer as a form of frequently recurring behavior is capable of stimulating the dopaminergic reward system in practicing individuals, so that there really is a neural substrate in the sense that the practice of prayer and the feeling of being rewarded in one's faith has this physical correlate in the dopaminergic system. And then they noticed that a group in Texas, the leader I think is Montague, Reed Montague, but various other people, they did a totally secular game with their parents, with their patients, subjects. They would have them play a game against someone else. And while they were playing this game, they would discover that the partner they were playing with was trustworthy or not. Was there, if they said they would make a move, would they really make that move or not? And they discovered that learning to trust partners was correlated with activity in the same area. So they're suggesting that maybe the caudate nucleus, this area that they showed was very active in prayer as distinct from these control conditions, was also involved in evaluating future rewards dependent on interpersonal reciprocity. So this fits in with the idea that if one is taking the view that the brain evolved not only to allow us to see the world, remember about the world, act in the world, but to act as social beings, then the issue of how we can trust people and build our actions on the confidence that they will act in a certain way versus finding people we can't trust provides a set of brain mechanisms that can be exploited in religion as one comes to put one's faith in another being who is way beyond the everyday community. About the last of the brain examples I want to look at is from a group in Montreal who studied Carmelite nuns. And here they were trying explicitly to compare a mystical condition against a non-mystical condition. Now, the nun said, well, I can't summon God at will. So in place of that, they asked the nuns to do the following. Remember and relive with your eyes closed the most intense mystical experience you've ever felt since you became a member of the Carmelite order. And that's the story that they used to get what they called the mystical condition, and then for comparison, they looked at the control condition, which was to remember and relive the most intense state of union with another human being you felt while you've been with the Carmelite order. So, as you'll see, a bunch of areas lit up, as we show in this. In other words, they were more active in the brain during the mystical condition for these nuns than for the control condition. And I'm not going to go through the list or to give you the attempt they made to see what each of these was doing. But what gives you a sense of that it's early days in this attempt to link brain and mysticism is, in some sense, this result almost contradicts the previous result I gave you, which said, look at the reward system for when you trust another person. We've got imaging results that says that's operative when you trust in the Lord. And here we've got a control condition, which is remember intense experiences with other people, and it doesn't have the same brain activation as an intense mystical experience that you have felt of, in some sense, union with God. So we have the beginning of understanding how it is that our brain has evolved to support a range of experiences as actors and as members of a community. And in studies like this, we have some understanding of how it may be that such a brain is adequate to support religious belief if you are in a community. Because I want to return to an important point from Lisa's discussion, and that is that when people have these mystical experiences, whether it's seeing that stormy sunset or thinking they're having a vision, it is so conditioned by the social milieu. You don't have a Christian having a vision of Krishna and things of this kind. So it is that it's rather that we have this state of ill-defined yearning that is crystallized by the brain that we have in terms of its social experience, which provides a vocabulary. And again, this I think was part of Lisa's talk, was that there is a history of communities trying to find a way to talk about their experiences. But when they've learned how to talk about it, this is something that is physically encoded in the brain and makes their brain different from somebody who comes from another religious community. I want to close with these pictures from Notre Dame, or Notre Dame as they say in this country, in Paris, to make this point again about the socialization, as it were, of religious experience, that here is a building designed by men of great faith who are trying to find a way to capture in stone and stained glass the experience of union with God in such a way then that any worshipper who came in here would feel that play of color through the stained glass, would feel that dramatic uplifting of space towards the heavens. And so again, we see not in terms of the brain, but rather in terms of architecture, the way in which a community, having for whatever reason begun to decide that its experiences are not to be interpreted simply of, oh, that was an incredible sunset, but, oh, I felt some union with the Lord, of finding ways of institutionalizing that so that people who are not having those mystical experiences themselves are nonetheless invited to become part of the community in which those take place. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. That was a huge amount of food for thought. Lisa, I wanted to start off with a couple of follow-up questions for you. A couple of years ago, I met a man who was writing a book on contemporary visions, and he told me that the way that he got his subjects was he simply went around the world and put advertisements in local newspapers asking for people who'd had. And he found no lack of subjects. In fact, he'd met several hundred people this way, just ordinary people from all walks of life, all over America and all over Europe. Do we have any sense of how many people today do experience mystical visions or religious visions?
It depends on what you mean by mystical. In fact, when I first started studying the Lady of the Rock, Maria Paula, whom I showed you a picture of, Matt and I thought about how to find people who were willing to talk about the visions they'd had, and we put a Matt did this, not me, put an ad in Craigslist asking people to get in touch if they'd seen anything religiously significant. And I think we just got like two rude messages or something, was it? I would say from the traffic on the web and from talking to other people who study visions, I'm thinking, for example, of my friend Bill Christian, who's been a vision hunter all his life and is an anthropologist, so he knows these things, that what we see is the tip of the iceberg, that everybody sees something that he or she can't explain. I mean, we do it all the time. You know, the only question is whether in the cultural context you're able and willing to talk about it or to find terms for it. And it's quite common even in the Middle Ages for people to note down that, as St. Francis did, oh, when I first saw that, I thought I was going crazy or I thought I was sick or something like that. So I agree with Bill. I think it's the tip of the iceberg, but how your friend had success in actually getting those people to talk to him, that's something I'd like to know.
Of the people who specifically claim, though, that they have actually seen the Virgin or Jesus, I mean, presumably, I think you're right, there's a lot more of the general encounter with the supernatural, or at least the unexplainable. But of the people who specifically say that they've seen a religious figure, do we have any patterns about these people? Are they of certain ages, socioeconomic groups, genders?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the points that sort of underlies what I was my larger points. You can observe patterns over years, in regions, over centuries. You know, I mentioned that beginning in about the 1820s, all of a sudden all the Catholic visions were of the Virgin Mary. And part of that has to do with social and political context, with the shift in church leadership, the growth of nations, with you know, the emergence of, after industrialization, of particular class structures in Europe. All of a sudden, the only people having visions were peasants, children, uneducated women. You know, go figure, right? What they saw was a mother figure, a protectress, and someone who traditionally could intercede for those classes of people with God. The other thing is that visions lead to visions, and people develop a vocabulary of authenticity. So if someone sees the Virgin Mary, and she's dressed like you see in paintings, and her messages echo the gospel, and other people believe you when you convey the vision in that way, well, the next person who has a vision uses the same vocabulary. And visionaries attend other visionaries, and this is one way that the ability to interpret these experiences spreads. So yeah, you can track mm-hmm. patterns in visions.
And one of the patterns that I know you've written about is that where the Virgin Mary appears seems to change geographically from, I believe, that in the 19th century and up until about the 1950s, she mainly appeared in Europe. And then she started to appear in Central Europe, and now she appears in America.
Yeah, and you, of course, you can contextualize that. You can think about immigration movements. You can think about where Catholicism, what populations it's strongest in, you know. You can think about who has access to the technology that can allow them to spread the visions. The World Wide Web now, I mean, Americans, more educated Americans, have access to the web. It's cheaper here. You know, we dominate, so we spread the visions.
Of course, one could also say that God was speaking to the people who wished to speak to him.
And that is what some people say, yeah.
Michael, I wanted to ask you if you could just give us a little bit of a brief context of this new emerging field of neurotheology. You showed some fantastic examples of specific changes that happen that seem to occur in the brains of people who tend to be believers or in some sort of visionary or meditative state. But could you sort of give us an overall sense of what is the purpose that neurotheologists would like to achieve? I mean, why study religious visions in neurological terms?
Because it's there. No, I mean, if you look at how many people there are who are deeply religious, even whether you're an atheist or a believer, it's something that the human brain does. So if you want to give a complete theory of the human brain, you have to address those phenomena. And then, depending on your background, you may either say, oh, I am a believer, and so I want to understand how God helped design the brain so that it could have these experiences. I'm not a believer, and so I look at it in terms of what is it about our social evolution and our biological evolution that gets us to the point where we need to answer certain questions. And I think, for me, I've been studying a lot the evolution of the brain that allows us to use language where no other creature can. And I think what's most significant about language is that we can ask questions. And what's really interesting about questions is that we want to believe the answers. So, I mean, if you just think about the recent political campaign, whether you were on the left or the right, we each wanted to desperately believe that our politicians were giving us the right answers. And if you ask, well, what's your evidence? Have you followed in great detail the health policies of both sides? No, but it's clear that, and so on. So I think that, and then the other point that came up implicitly in what I was saying before is that a lot of the work on the brain focused very much on the lone individual. How does vision work in the normal sense of how do the eyes register impressions that are sent to the brain to see what's going on in the world? How does hearing work? How do our muscles get controlled by the brain? And a big movement in the last 15 years, I would say, is towards a social cognitive neuroscience to say, but we didn't evolve as atoms. We evolved as members of communities. And so a lot of what our brain does is allow us, I mean, obviously child rearing is the most basic example, but again and again, there are issues of social interaction. So to see religion, whether, as I say, you do it as a believer or not, to see this as an extended form where the community goes, as it were, from the immediate family to the tribe to all of mankind to embrace the whole universe, this is an incredibly interesting question.
I'd like to tell you a story, and just I'd be interested from a neuroscience point of view, what would be your response? Some years ago, after these studies began to get done, where people began to say, okay, well, Hildegard of Bingen may have simply been having epileptic fits, or at least that her visions were commensurate with somebody who was having quite profound epileptic seizures, and the neurology that we now understand that seemed to bear it out. And I was with Father George Coyne, who was the Vatican. He's an astronomer and a Jesuit priest who's was for a long time the head of the Vatican Observatory. And I said to him, Father Coyne, what do you feel about this claim that someone like Hildegard may simply have been having epileptic seizures? And he said, actually, I don't have a problem with the idea that she was having an epileptic seizure at all, because if God was talking to you, it would be an extraordinary physiological experience to produce any sort of psychological experience. But as he went on to say, what it doesn't bear any relevance to is that it doesn't preclude the idea that God was also talking to her. So, in a sense, I think what I'm trying to understand here is what do neuroscientists hope to achieve? Is it in some sense to convince people that it is only a physiological phenomena, or is that not the purpose?
Okay, well, a lot of Christian scientists, as distinct from Christian scientists, do not believe in any miracles except one, and that is the resurrection. And they believe that that God created the universe with certain laws of operation, which then led in time to the emergence of humans with their brains, and that the way in which it emerged then can support, in particular, the ability to worship God. So I would think that there's no need to separate the physical from the spiritual in that sense. Interestingly, the time I met Father Coyne was at a meeting in Poland, And before the meeting, I was asked to come in as the person representing the brain for a meeting on divine action in the brain. And I thought that the focus of debate would be, I would be a monist. In other words, everything can be reduced to what the brain does. And all the Christians there would be dualists. But in fact, I was wrong, because it turned out they all believed in the resurrection of the body. So that, in fact, you didn't have to have a soul separate from the body, because when you were called to the kingdom of heaven, you would be there with your brain. So I asked, in fact, this was Nancy Murphy, who's a professor up in Pasadena at the Fuller Theological Seminary. I asked, well, if you are resurrected in the body, how old will you be? And without skipping a beat, she said 38.
Well, of course, that was the subject of immense debate during the Middle Ages,
wasn't it? I mean,
what exactly would be resurrected? Would all your hair be resurrected?
Oh, and they worried terribly about people who were consumed by animals or cannibals. You know, would you be resurrected in bits? Would you be reassembled? It's like, you know.
But anyway, the point is going back that if, in fact, you believe that the brain is what is responsible for your mental and, in particular, religious life, but you are a person of faith, then you will strive to understand how God designed it in such a way that you could have religious experiences. And the ability to have temporal lobe seizures as a way of encouraging a religious experience will then just be seen as this is the price you pay to be able to have these mystic experiences more frequently than other people.
Right. So it would, from that perspective, it would be by studying the physiological process, we are articulating the fullness of the ways in which God's made it possible for us to interact with him.
Right. And then from a clinical point of view, you would be saying, okay, I have patients who have various problems, and so I want to do a complete run-up on the symptomatology so that I can understand what I can do to treat them. And then they would be seeing the religious experience not as something wonderful to celebrate, but as a symptom of an underlying disorder, which they would then have to treat.
Well, there's a very good novel about exactly that, Mark Saltzman's book, Lying Awake, about a mystic who is diagnosed with a brain tumor and is told or realizes that if the tumor is removed, she'll stop having visions. So it's about her dilemma.
And?
She has it removed, but she realizes it's for the good of the community because she was a burden as a visionary.
Well, there's also been a very interesting case of something. There's been a fantastically interesting case of something similar to this actually going on in real life recently with this woman, Jill Bolt Taylor. Do any of you?
No.
Jill Bolt Taylor was a Harvard neuroscientist, and she, about 8 years ago, there'd been a tumour growing in her brain, which suddenly, basically, she had a massive stroke, which wiped out the right-hand side of her brain. And she went into a state of essentially nirvana, because it wiped out the part of her brain that was able to, as it were, make divisions between self and other. And 8 years later, she's just written this book called My Stroke of Insight, and it's been sort of all over the web, etc. But what's very interesting about it is that she had this very specific part of her brain knocked out, and it put her into the state, which is what people who go into Tibetan monasteries, etc., strive for 30 years to achieve. And at some point after she'd had this, she made a conscious decision to, as she puts it, come back to the world. But it is clear that the neurology affected her experience. And I mean, one of the interesting things that I wondered if your work sheds any light on, Lisa, is do we have any reason to believe that people who have mystical experiences have any, as it were, physical characteristics that might present, or physiological characteristics that might sort of encourage them to have these visions?
You know, this is another thing that people throughout the centuries were wondering too. I mean, as I mentioned to Michael, you know, St. Jerome in 300 said, when you encounter a visionary, send him to the doctor first thing, you know, to have him checked out. And you know, over time people observed things like, you know, melancholy attending hermits, or, you know, a lot of people practiced fasting and then had visions. So Historically, people have cited various things that then medical historians have gone back and said, you know, oh, this is, you know, bodily deprivation, or this is migraine or epilepsy, as we mentioned, or things like that. But always these things, like these modern tests of Carmelite nuns, you know, having their brains surveyed, these are filtered through the lens of culture. So what they see and experience necessarily comes through their mouths to whoever is examining and diagnosing, which I think makes the studies that Michael showed us, you know, at least it makes it problematic for me in a historical sense to accept.
What specifically is it that's problematic for you?
What's problematic for me is that no individual can ever see what another individual sees. And so the experience, however it actually is, as well as how it is explained or perceived, necessarily comes through the filter of that individual's perception, right? Mm-hmm. So you can measure nuns all you want, but if you're telling them, imagine God, what you say to them is filtered and what they say back to you is filtered. And then you measure those results. Well, how does culture interfere with that?
Mm-hmm. And in a way, I mean, it gets back to Michael Ray's, William James's beautiful book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, which basically starts off with what was, in 1901, an incredibly radical definition of religion, which is essentially religion is what a person of faith deems it to be for themselves, which at the time was extremely controversial. But in a sense, what James was claiming was that the primary quality of religion is its subjectivity. And that, in fact, we have to take the subjective account as it were, the primary data. What do you as a neuroscientist, you obviously admire James, Michael, what do you as a neuroscientist feel about that statement that James made, that religious data is essentially the subjective data?
Well, it doesn't help me very much. I think the point that I was stressing earlier, that we begin to understand better the way in which people's experience reflects that of people around them, and the extent to which our experience, although individual, is socially constructed, I think does put us in the position now, 100 years later, to begin to add new chapters to what James said. And he was very much aware of the neurology of his time, but we've come a long way since then.
But what disturbs me still is that people very often, in thinking about these things, don't stop to think that science itself has discourses. I mean, we know when we stop and think about it. But there's a tendency when considering these studies of visionaries to diagnose them. I mean, we've talked about this a little bit. So that even if you're trying to generate some sort of neutral results about whether an experience was or wasn't religious and, you know, what was going on in the brain at the time it happened, still the study results are presented to the world in terms of studying bizarre aberrations in humans, not sort of typical humans.
Well, the problem is, if you're going to do a brain imaging study, you have to be able to get a condition that can be imaged. I think the group that did the Carmelite nun study were fairly careful in the sense that they tried to set up a condition, the mystical condition, that got them not to, as it were, experience the mystical situation, but to relive it to the extent they could through memory. And then afterwards, they carefully interviewed them to see, tell us what you experienced during that. And then it turns out, I didn't know this until I was preparing for this talk, there is a mysticism rating scale. And so you can you can go through and tick off. And so it was crucial that when they imaged these people, their mysticism rating passed 15. To allow them to do it. So I mean, I think there are some people making a real attempt to get inside that. Otherwise, you just say everybody is in their own subjectivity, and we can't discuss whether we do it as a humanist or a scientist.
Could I just do a little poll? And I'd be interested to know if there's anyone in the audience who has had a religious vision, and of course you may not feel comfortable about acknowledging it publicly, but I would be interested to know, are there people in the audience who've had such experiences?
Okay.
Yes. Well, I think we can open it up to questions, indeed. We have microphone.
Thank you. My question is, vision is so attached to sight. And it suggests that the kind of, and yet sight was the lowest category on your scale. So you would have to open up, I would suggest or think, that you would have to open up this question of vision to other senses beyond sight. And then it maybe would be easier, or then that it could be more inclusive, that, or it would include me.
Oh, that was mysterious. I'm sitting here trying to think what happened to you. I'm not trying to say plus ça change. I mean, visions change over time, obviously, but throughout the centuries, people notice, for example, nice smells when they have visions. I don't know if there's a neurological basis in that, but scents of roses or perfume or things like that.
Well, heavenly music is not uncommon too, I believe.
But I think that's where religious experience, mystical experience, ultimacy doesn't commit you to the word vision, and I think the word vision becomes much more generic. If I talk to a blind person, they'll say, "I see what you mean." So you can use words in a metaphorical sense. But one of the things that one does as a scientist is specialize. So it's very easy to become an expert just on the visual system, or an expert just on the auditory system, or an expert on short-term memory, but not long-term memory. And what's now happening is we're trying to, while this barrage of detailed information continues, to step back a little more and in particular understand the way in which the emotional system links into the sensory systems, and then the social experience affects it. So I don't think there's anything really in what we said, although that word vision keeps coming up. I don't think there's anything there. It is that more that emotional feeling. It's not that you see something, and let's forget that nonsense about the grilled cheese sandwich. I think it was actually a young starlet rather than the Virgin Mary myself.
It looks like a 40s film star, yes. Doesn't it?
Yeah. Do you want to tell us about your non-vision vision? Or?
It's too long a story.
Okay. There's a question up here.
I actually had one that might count. And this was several years ago, 5-7 years ago. I woke up in the morning with Enoch, E-N-O-C-H. And I had no idea what Enoch was. But I knew it was a name in the Bible. And so I opened up the Old Testament and I found there's Enoch, who's like the seventh generation of Adam, seventh descendant of Adam. But then the thing that was strange is, now I'd read the Bible before, so I probably had heard the name Enoch before. But it led me into a whole kind of a source of research, and I found that the Enoch was really important in Christian history. In fact, there's a book of Enoch that's in the Ethiopian Bible that was not included in the canon of the Jewish or the Catholic Christian Bible. And it was interesting to me that I had this vision. It was just the letters E-N-O-C-H. And that I woke up like they were stamped on the wall or something like that. And it led to a unfolding of a really interesting research to the point where if you read Eisenman, who writes about the history of the early Christian church, that the early Christians who weren't Pauline Christians were, in his words, Enochian Christians. So... and that led. So anyway, that was my vision.
Lisa, do people who study visions make a difference between this gentleman seems to be suggesting he was asleep. I mean, whereas many people, you know, things like Medjugorje and Fatima, they're fully awake. Is there considered to be a difference?
Not before the present day. You know, in the Bible, it's in visio noctis, right? In a vision of the night. That's one of the big changes, I think, between the pre- and post-Freudian age, is that now we're all sort of suspicious of our own dreams. Maybe it relates to terrible things in childhood. But in the old days, dreams had completely different meanings, and many of them were religious.
This gentleman here.
In talking about
about visions, if you're in California, if you opened up to those who have used something else to elevate the brain, let's say, to a different place.
I saw the Doors.
and that, you know, you've talked about it in terms of an iconography, which is religious. But how, both from the study of the brain, the neuroscience, and from a comparison with the religious, LSD, peyote, all of these things, how do those fit together? Are they different?
Lisa, would you?
No, he can go first.
Or would you like to go first on this one? It's a huge, huge question, but
I don't think I have anything very useful to say, except yes, there are many religions in which, and non-religions in which, the taking of drugs is part of the sacrament or just part of the trip. We do have, at NIH, the National Institute of Health has a very large section involved in the study of the effects of drugs, and in particular the effects of drugs on the brain. So we do begin to understand various systems, and in particular the way in which addiction can take the reward system from, hey, you get your reward and you're happy, to you get your reward but it's not enough and you crave more and more. And so this idea of being it going from an immediate experience to a long-term experience that involves you more and more. Now, that's a negative view, but one might hope, and this is speculation, one might hope to, in the same way, discover how one becomes committed to something in the way you want more. I mean, for me, it's science. I'm an addict, and I can't go too long without doing some science, right? So it may be that religion and drugs and scientific interests and hobbies are all things where there is this business of how you go from taking something that is not within your experience, and then it becomes not only part of the experience but a craving, so that if you go without it for too long, you have to do something to recapture that experience again. So there's a lot of literature out there on addiction and so on, and maybe in the end that could make contact back with the issues we've been discussing here.
Lisa, Christianity doesn't have really much of a tradition of drug taking as a path to the divine.
All that bread and wine.
Well, it's true, the Catholics invented most of the good liqueurs, but it's true, it's actually a fact. But from a theological perspective, what is
the problem with Christianity, of course, is that there's an ascetic drive in the doctrine. So, you know, it's all about self-denial. So, you know, none of the magic mushrooms or anything for Christian visionaries. And I think I mentioned the only sort of bodily practice that traditionally Christians use, as you guys both know. You know, there's prayer, and then there's self-denial in terms of fasting, or the penitents in various periods used to go stand in really cold water naked and pray, you know, or self...
flagellation.
Yeah, abuse, basically, but yeah, painful, not pleasurable. So, there's no psychedelic, unfortunately, tradition.
This woman over here.
Coming from a different, I don't come from a Christian tradition, I come from a Jewish tradition. First, and certainly there's a lot of psychologists and psychotherapists who are Jewish and hear about mystical experiences or spiritual experiences like this all the time, and say that one person's spiritual experience is another person's crazy. And so, you know, the line, I think, now is that people are afraid that someone will commit them to an institution, or someone will take away their autonomy if they talk about these sorts of things, especially it seems like we live in a very rational world. But my question is, what do you find is the significance, both historically and religiously, as well as scientifically, for people in revealing or having these sorts of experiences?
Well, actually, as you were speaking, I was thinking of my own family and my in-laws who, you know, think what I'm studying in the desert is absolutely insane, because there is, they observe no tradition of a visionary experience. But, I mean, just speaking from the history of Christianity, there's a long tradition of discarding certain visions and visionaries by labeling them as nut jobs, basically. I mean, that's what I said St. Jerome said. And my friend Andrew back there has been studying theologians in Paris in the 1300s who were learning the techniques of doctors, picking up medical expertise, exactly so that they could practice discernment of visionaries. But I don't know from the...
I have nothing useful to say, but I imagine it's, again, a matter of community. If you are within a community where such things occur, then you will be happy to get in on the act. If you're in a community where people are skeptical about it, you may feel very embarrassed. And it's got nothing to do with religion in particular. It's true in all our walks of life. There is always a certain norm in the society. And you have to make a conscious decision whether or not you want to break with the norm. If the norm is to have visions, then great, let's do it.
And even in communities where visions are an accepted part of the tradition, like in Catholicism, it's always been the case, certainly in the past, that one of the primary reasons to be apprehensive about announcing your visions was not that you'd be declared a nutcase, but that you'd be declared a heretic. And particularly for women, it was really quite a dangerous thing to do, to claim that you were having a direct communication with God, because it threatens the whole notion that the purpose of Christianity is get us all collectively to have the communion with God at the end of time. So the visionary sort of is a challenge to the hierarchy of the church to say, well, I can commune directly with God. And, I mean, it still remains the case, my understanding is, Lisa, that most visionaries today are not, I don't know if there are any visionaries today who are actually recognized by the Vatican, for instance.
Not living ones. The jury's still out on Medjugorje, mainly because the Virgin has delivered so many messages and they're so repetitive. The Vatican suddenly stopped and thought, wait, would she really repeat herself so endlessly? So, no, there, I don't think anyone's been approved since Fatima in 1917. Mm-hmm. Still investigating. But just about Jewish tradition, you know, I've been wondering and studying medieval visionaries about how to work in Kabbalists, you know, and there's no iconic tradition, obviously, but there is a tradition of sort of visualization. I'm not exactly sure of what besides numbers and letters, but, you know.
I had a little less of an philosophical question, more for the scientists. I myself had a stroke when I was 19, and before that had, I guess in high school, rejected my Baptist upbringing, and through my stroke experience, began to feel more connected to something bigger and things like that. And now I'm coming into this discussion with, like, wow, there's people out here studying this. You know, where can I go to be studied?
Well, I put a few names up of people who do conduct these studies. You're not a Carmelite nun, but... Maybe they would make an exception. I think actually if you go and just, I mean, one way to start is there's something called Google Scholar, which is scientific papers rather than normal, just the ordinary web items. And if you put in there things like mysticism, brain imaging, stroke, or things of this kind, you'll get a number of the recent papers in the subject, and then you could perhaps write to those experts. I'm not doing that directly myself at the moment, so I'm afraid I can't offer to probe your mysteries.
But that's such an interesting question because, you know, I think if you went to my father-in-law, the neurologist, he would say, you know, meshuggah, you know. I mean, you're totally out of your mind. And the question would be, where can you go to a doctor who might be sensitive to the religious or philosophical implications of what you've experienced? Jeez, I don't know.
Well, as I say, I mean, if you want to send me an email, arbib@usc.edu, I can send you half a dozen references, and then you can look at those papers and see if those people are worth writing to.
Well, there is also an institute called, I think it's the Center for Mind and Life, based up in Boston, which it's one of these Templeton-funded things. I think it's called the Center for Mind and Life, who have been doing a lot of studies on religious... they're trying to find sort of positive scientific things to say about religious experience. So they've done a lot of these studies. Now, I don't know what...
Is this Novak?
Yeah, isn't it called the thing, Center for Mind and Life, something like that. But they're in Boston, and there are quite a lot of people at the moment who are interested in studying people who have had religious experiences, and there is a desire to demonstrate in some quarters that something physiological has positively happened to these people. So I'm sure if you Google these things, you will not have a lot of trouble finding. Whether they will accept you as a subject is another question. Could you just wait for the microphone, because we're recording it as well?
I've noticed from listening to you that all your examples are from Christianity. Are there examples from other religions, say, beside Judaism?
Oh, yeah, loads of them. I mean, I have a colleague at SC who's studying Buddhist visions and dream visions and things like that. I mean, I'm sure you could check out any major or minor religious tradition, for that matter, and find a visionary tradition, a prophetic tradition, or some combination. So.
And the first study I showed was Tibetan meditation practices.
Oh, actually, we'll take one from this side.
Could you comment on mental illness, schizophrenia with hallucinations and having visions? In terms of, do your brain scans distinguish them from these other Carmelite experiences?
Well, I don't know specifically for that. The issue in schizophrenia, where you have various things like the idea that an act that you committed was not committed by you, but was committed by an outsider, and things of this kind, certainly share some of these aspects. And we've been looking at some ideas about maybe lack of inhibition. We often formulate plans of action, but in general, we have to make a conscious decision to let that action emerge and be executed. And so one of the ideas that we've been discussing is that the system that normally regulates this is deficient, so that because the inhibition is inadequate, ideas that you might have been entertaining, perhaps not even consciously, will go forth to overt behavior. But since you have no memory of allowing that behavior, you then confabulate to say, well, how did that happen? I didn't let it happen. And then you make sense of it. So the simile with people who will sub-vocalize without realizing that they cause that sub-vocalization, and so they then interpret that as what others said. So I think that the general pattern in those two cases is the idea that you may do things without being aware that you did them, and then you try to make sense of it. And so that general idea that you've got brain states, and we don't normally allow ourselves to just say, oh, there's static on the brain. We try to form a pattern that interprets it and makes sense of it, and that allows us to get ourselves sometimes into real trouble where the interpretation is so objectionable to what we need to do to function normally.
And I think he was also hoping that you would shed some light, Michael, on the issue of do we know that these scans, for instance, that you showed of the Carmelite nuns, if you did such a test on someone who was a schizophrenic, would you be able to tell the difference? Or, I mean,
we would be able to tell the difference, but I can't comment on whether, if you really started probing, you would find something in common. That's beyond what we currently know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what about someone from this side of the room? Yes, up there.
Yes, this is for Dr. Vitale. Obviously, something compelled you to do all this. What are you searching for? What is the thing that you need to find in this research?
Wow, that's a really hard question. I guess it, for me, it was also an issue of why would people describe the sorts of really fantastical things they do in medieval sources and pretend to believe them. That's how I started out thinking about this. I was just thinking of this as Michael was starting, was explaining in the last question about schizophrenics, and that made my mind drift towards possessed people, and thinking how in the Middle Ages there were physical signs of possession, this dual personality, and a story in a 5th century saint's life, in which 6th century saint's life, in which 12 possessed people with demons inside them, are brought to a saint to be healed, and they're brought, they're floating in the air when they're brought, and they're bound with ropes, and she sort of tugs them down like balloons, and then says a blessing, and they land, you know? And I guess it's the effort to say things like that can be explained without having to say everybody who lived before we did was stupid and superstitious and lacked science. That and a particularly meaningful dream about Aerosmith that I had, actually.
Down here for our last question. Yes, down here.
The discussion seems to be focusing on visionary experiences a lot, which may be a single experience or repeated. And it seems to me that there's a whole other tradition in Christianity in terms of mysticism, and that you mentioned the varieties of religious experience, but there's another tradition, Evelyn Underhill, and her writings on mysticism. And in that book, she really addresses more the mystics, the kind of mysticism that is really more interior and doesn't really result in visions or it's not corporeal. So what I wondered is, and she also emphasizes that these are people who are following actually a method, a kind of a way of living, a path, which would be like the Buddhist, I would imagine, or the Hindu, you know, whatever they are in Hinduism. You know, so that I wonder about, you know, that difference in terms of people who just have a visionary experience and the people who are more on a path where they practice, have a either meditation or something in a consistent manner. And she talks about, you know, all of the ways of demonstrating that they're true mystics. Can you comment on that?
So. Well, I can tell you that in giving talks like this, I tend to reduce the variety of Christian and other religious experience to the cool stuff, and that there is the kind of thing that Michael kind of referred to when he was talking about the Carmelites or, you know, Tibetan monks, this practice, this education of the body and mind and soul to achieve a different kind of if not visionary, religious experience. But besides seeing that tradition, yeah, you're right, it's strong in Christianity as well as in other religions.
So I think it is the case, is it not, Michael, that most of these studies, these neurological studies that have been done, have really been done more on the kind of people that you're referring to, people who are engaged in long-term practices, like the studies have been done on Carmelite nuns who've obviously been Carmelite nuns.
I think the Carmelite nuns were nuns for many years, but there was the attempt to find people who could,
yes,
in some sense, have an approximation to a mystical vision which could, yes, be studied. Whereas with the looking at people saying the Lord's Prayer and looking at people meditating, mm-hmm, there it was more the kind of person you were talking about, I think.
Because, of course, it's very difficult scientifically to study the mystical experience, the visionary experience. Because most people don't, you know, they have it once in their life. I mean, I was quite fascinated with your example, Lisa, of someone who has it once a month. I mean, is it on the same day of the month as the Virgin Mary? Is she on time at 10 a.m. on a Thursday?
Yeah, and she's not the only one, too. I mean, the woman who sees the Virgin Mary. I mean, the Virgin is quite punctual and with many visionaries.
And is she? What happens if the visionary is late? Does the Virgin accommodate for that?
Good question, but there's one of the six guys from Medjugorje travels around the world, and wherever he goes, she appears to him at the same time, and except with an hour variation for daylight saving, but time zones don't seem to affect it. There are actually anthropologists have theorized that it has to do with the visual environment of television, where you expect to see something in a precise time every day, and that this is influenced seeing visions. So,
well, on that note, thank you very much for all coming. I think it's been a marvelous discussion. Thanks very much, Lisa.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.